Somebody said it snowed in Arizona today. I don't understand. But I'm so glad that you're here. So glad that you're part of the book club. And I want to bring Reverend Dr. Walter Pflueger onto the screen. If you can start your camera, Walter. Hello. Boy, all of you that are tuning in are part of the book club, so you know what a gift it's been to have Dr. Pflueger lead us through Howard Thurman's book. How are you doing today, Walter?
I'm good. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Ah, it's been an honor and a pleasure. And now we're really going to make you work. Yeah, I have this stack of reader submitted questions, and Walter has graciously agreed to answer as many of them as we can get to. So you ready to just dive in?
I'm ready to dive in.
All right. Let me say to everyone tuning in, thank you for submitting so many thoughtful questions. I already know we probably won't get to them all, so I apologize in advance, but we will get to a bunch. If, as we're talking, you have a follow-up question or something that you really hope that we can get to, go ahead and use the Q&A icon on your screen. And if we can, before the end of the hour, we'll get to some of those live questions. You're also totally free to chat with each other in the chat, but we won't be looking at the chat. I'll just check the Q&A area if there's time. All right. Well, let's begin. The first question is from Sylvia. And so the first sort of group of questions I have here are kind of about Thurman's backstory and his historical context. So from Sylvia, who was Thurman's primary audience as he was writing Jesus and the Disinherited?
That's a very good question. I think he was the first. It was to him. It was a project that he had been working on most of his adult life, beginning in the 1920s. And he was primarily concerned, as he says in the book, in the first chapter, An Interpretation, that he was trying to answer the question, what does the religion of Jesus have to say to those whose backs are against the wall? So it was to Thurman. This was his theological project. And in many ways, I think it was his personal project, vocation. Secondly, of course, it is to African Americans who were part of this long history of slavery, Jim Crow, segregation. And Thurman saw his quest as part of the reckoning of ideology, religion, and culture in the United States of America. So he's addressing it to the disinherited, though, of every race and class. And if he were here, he'd say gender and other things. And then finally, I think that for our benefit, it's addressed to us.
I like it. Yeah, and it is beneficial for us. Deliza, and I hope I'm saying her name right, Deliza. She said, to me, it appears that in Jesus and the Disinherited, Howard Thurman is giving specific language to the effect of the powerful over the powerless. Was he the first to do this for African Americans? And how did this language impact the civil rights leaders and movement?
I like to place, again, a very good question. I like to place Thurman within a religious and moral tradition of the dissenting loyalists to what has been called the American Democratic Experiment. It's longstanding, and it begins not just with the first African who arrived on the scene, but there's always been a dissenting tradition that's been a part of America. Of course, the issue of race looms large for Thurman, so he is part of this tradition, which really comes to zenith at the turn of the 20th century. This is right after the Civil War, Reconstruction, and at the turn of the 20th century, there are rampant race riots all over this country. Normally, we pinpoint the South, but they were in Illinois, they were in Tulsa, all over this country. And Thurman sees himself as an interpreter of these experiences And he would never say this, but I think also as a prophetic voice. So he's not the first. There were many African Americans in particular who preceded Thurman in this tradition. And here in Georgia, where I am, you had Bishop Henry McNeil Turner. Of course, you had the greats like Frederick Douglass, whom Thurman admired greatly, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, and the list is long. But there was always a focal point on how religious authority spoke to the moral situation of the United States of America in respect to slavery, segregation, and racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's part of a long tradition, and also as king and so many others.
Right. Louise asks, so this book was written before the civil rights movement that in the 60s. She asks, did the civil rights unrest of the 60s change Thurman's thesis at all?
I think in many ways, Thurman tries to address that, Louise, in one of his last books entitled The Search for Common Ground. At the end of the 60s, with the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, kind of a violent context. So we need to be reminded of that nowadays. Thurman is dealing with a new emergent movement within the Black community, Black consciousness and Black power. And in volume 5 of our documentary edition, if you ever want to get your hands on it, we name some of the folks he's in conversation with. And he's trying to bring to fore what he sees as the rising movement for change, which he agrees with, which he embraces. And yet he's so afraid that this new clash might be the cause. He says the logic of this may be the cause for losing some of the noble gains that we've had in the modern civil rights movement. So the late 60s, the early 70s, Thurman is reckoning with Black consciousness, Black power over against what he saw as the gains of the modern civil rights movement.
That's really interesting. There's some questions later coming up about sort of how his thinking maps onto movements now. So looking forward to that. In the meantime, while we're still kind of in the 60s, Linda wondered if you know how MLK's assassination affected Thurman, and whether once Martin Luther King Jr. was lost, did that change Thurman's influence in the civil rights movement?
I have a twofold response as a way of getting at some. Of course it did. Thurman was very close, not just to Martin King, but to the King family. Particularly close, he and his wife, Sue Bailey Thurman, to Coretta. There's correspondence always to Coretta, and their concern for the children as Martin is out there, you know, fighting for justice. So, yes, and he gives a eulogy on King, I think, 2 days after the assassination. It was on a San Francisco radio station, WK, whatever those letters are. But it's a powerful eulogy, and I'm sure you can find it if you look for it. But he's questioning the moral fiber of United States of America. He uses America. I use United States of America because we are the United States of America. We're not America by ourselves.
I think as a Canadian, I thank you for that. Yes.
Yeah. So this eulogy, though, I wish we could listen to it, and if you'd like, I can find it for you later.
Yeah, we'll post it later.
The cause of King's death. And he attributes it not just to the assassin, but to the climate of violence, something that is organic and, my language, sinister, evil. But he says there's a climate of violence. And so the person who pulled the trigger he says, was riven with suspicion and a lack of ethical awareness. And that's Thurman's language to say, ignorance breeds arrogance. And this arrogance, of course, is attached to white supremacy. And we still have a reckoning in America. By 1976, though, Thurman is very disappointed in the United States of America. In fact, he says at the end of an essay and a sermon at Redlands in 1976, he believes school is out for America. He metaphorically thought of America as a school, as a place where human beings were being tutored in the art of democracy and genuine communal existence. He said, this was just an experiment in the mind of God. We got a shot at it and didn't learn our lessons. That's the essential message in it. But he says he thinks school is out for America.
Yeah.
It's kind of alarming coming from such a hopeful person. He still had hope, but that hope was not as heavily placed in the United States of America as it was early on.
Yeah, we have some questions about that later too, if we get
That's
to them.
That's attached to religion too. When you come back to the question, we saw religion playing out as well.
Yeah, yeah. A couple people asked, Linda and Gil, both, I'll ask it in Linda's words first. She says, why is it that Thurman has become a virtual forgotten prophet in the American church? Now, I don't know if you agree with that assessment. The big project of your life has been making sure one of them anyways, has been making sure he's not forgotten. But why isn't he, better known? I'm sure you've thought about that a lot.
Thank you for the question. What's the most obvious answer that comes to your mind? Yes, that was it. But there's more. Thurman is not just an African-American intellectual who is religious. He's also religious, and he's an intellectual. So he's combating some countervailing forces on the one hand. W.E.B. Du Bois, great African-American pioneer intellectual, said once, what Howard Thurman thinks, I'm not quite sure. And that was a kind of a slight because of his religious commitment. But yet, on the other hand, those in the Christian church, many did not even know Thurman existed because of the ways in which he understood not just the religion of Jesus, but the religion about Jesus.
Right.
He really thought that was the centermost question for the American church. How do you make a distinction between the religion of Jesus and the religion about Jesus? Mm-hmm. And there weren't many takers for that radical idea that perhaps there's a difference. And so his is a critique, Carolyn, of what I like to share with my students of ideology, culture, and religion. They're melded together. And Thurman saw his project as, how do we look at the ways in which ideology and culture hold religion in bondage to many of the ills of society, racism being central for him? And also, how does religion support and perpetuate the narrative of white supremacy? Well, these are hard questions that churches and many of the popular evangels, not just evangelicals, did not really want to reckon with, not in that way.
Right. So there wasn't any one particular tribe that felt like they were 100% okay with what he was doing. So that you think that's part of why his influence hasn't gone as wide as some other people, like kind of too nuanced, working too many. Yeah, really interesting.
In the 30s, he submitted to a publisher the manuscript that would later be Jesus and the Disinherited. It was entitled The Significance of Jesus.
The Significance of Jesus.
That publisher rejected the manuscript. and pick your own reasons out of that. But an African American of the stature of Thurman, I would think, would have had an audience at most places who could really understand what he was saying. I think some people were frightened by what he was proposing, not just white churches, black churches as well. Many people in black churches still don't know the name of Howard Thurman.
Interesting. Gail, along these same lines, said, how can we reveal Dr. Thurman to a wider audience? I'm almost 68 years old and I just met him this fall. So for people who have read this and really, really found him helpful, do you have suggestions how we can tell others about him?
I think showing the film produced by Martin Doblmeier, you probably know about it, Backs Against the Wall, is a wonderful way for wider audiences to meet Thurman. That's a specific interpretation of Thurman, but I think it's a good way to be introduced. I think other ways, however, are precisely what we're doing here. Making ourselves, as they used to say in my little storefront church, a committee of one, and making sure we share what we are hearing and seeing. And of course, last but not least, Thurman wrote over 22 books. Sometimes people say 23, but 22 books. And there is a burgeoning interest in Thurman right now. My colleague, Peter Eisenstadt, is releasing a new book next month called The Hound's Nail. Was the original title that Thurman had selected for Jesus and the Disinherited. It's a 300 plus, maybe 500 plus page biography, the most critical biography to date on him. I recommend it.
Excellent. Yeah. And you're in that other collection that just came out, Anchored in the Current. That's an interesting series of essays.
My former students, Gregory Ellison, who is a force in and of himself. I highly recommend him.
Yeah.
Is doing work in Thurman as well.
Yeah, exciting to see. I actually wanted to ask, when you mentioned a bit earlier, you said volume 5 of the documentary series. Can you explain what that is? What's the documentary series?
Now, if you can see above my head as well as I can, at the very top shelf, there are 5 volumes. They're called The Papers of Howard Washington Thurman.
Okay.
And there is a specific title that goes with each volume. It's chronologically arranged, and it's a collection of essays, of correspondence, where you really get to know the man, and all authored by him, without exception, and a number of obscurely published documents on Thurman. For instance, in volume 1, we published Thurman's meeting with Gandhi in 1936, out of the Harajan, which was Gandhi's word for child of God. But that was the organ. And this is Thurman's meeting, the Negro delegation, it was called, met with Gandhi.
Very cool. And are those, where can you?
They're available at the University of South Carolina. They are awfully expensive unless they read them. And we are presently working with the University of Virginia to create a digital collection of the same papers. So keep your eyes open. But for those who have the money and who dare to read, there's a 5-volume documentary on Howard Thurman. The last publication, I'm not marketing. I don't get any money from anything I do with Thurman except my talks. But all of the books that I publish go to the Howard Thurman Estate. And this book in back of me is the first in a series on Howard Thurman's sermon series.
Yeah, that's
and
exciting.
You get your hands on that at Orvis Press. This one is on the moral struggle and the prophets.
Is that what it's called? What's that one called?
That was right. Moral Struggle and the Prophets.
Volume
2 will be on mysticism.
Okay.
Sermons on mysticism.
Exciting. Thank you. Okay, my next group of questions that were submitted have to do with kind of Thurman's psychological insights and his understanding of the inner person and the inner life. And we'll start with this question from Philip. How would you describe Howard Thurman's spiritual psychology?
Well, as an academic, I go down the trail of people like Felix Adler, if that's a name. Others might be familiar with, who is one of the founders of the Ethical Cultural Society, where psychology and human spirituality are linked. These are kind of humanist trends. Maslow might have some say-so in Thurman because of self-actualization, hierarchy of needs. Thurman is huge on that. He read all of these people. I think the more prominent source for Thurman might very well be, always get the Adlers mixed up, Alfred Adler.
Huh.
This theme that Adler had about the inferiority complex and the need for recognition. I think I've got that right on that. But this incredible need, Thurman thinks that the human spirit, and not just humans, but nature, is begging to be seen, heard, and to be known. And wherever that is absent, he says that the streams dry up.
Huh.
We walk in the house filled with bombs. So there's a need for the other. Always there's a need for the other. And we very, very seldom do we just ask for it. We try to take it. We come up with deceptive ways, Jesus and the disinherited, of getting that. And that's self-destructive. But to be open, vulnerable to the other. And he thought religious experience was the best way to make this happen. The best way. In the experience that he called religious, which we have our different names for, spirituality, it's not just an individualistic impulse where I take care of Walter or Carolyn takes care of herself and her need. It's not just self-help for Thurman. It's tied to the other. In fact, if Thurman didn't say this, I'm quoting Maladoma Patrice Somay, but if I want to get home, I must give the other a ride and would be there. He's in that. I'm bound to you. I'm bound to you. I cannot escape you. And I need your love. Don't get that around the internet. I'm talking to the audience, but I need your love. And I can't be me until I find you. This is simply stated. So it's a relational understanding of human being. That's the spiritual psychology. It's relational, but it also has a strong dimension of self-actualization. How do I come to myself? How do I awaken consciousness? Because we already, Thurman thinks, are children of God. Nothing can take that from us. But how do we become aware of that? Self-knowledge is another way to think about it. And so meditation, for Thurman, prayer, are vehicles. They're not ends in of themselves, but they're instrumental in bringing to focus what is already there within us. And when we become conscious of ourselves, we also become conscious of our need for the other. The other is not just human beings.
Love it. You knew Thurman personally. Did he make you feel seen and known? Was he that kind of presence?
I don't know if I shared this in our first talk together, but I met Thurman while I was in seminary. I had read Thurman before when I was a chaplain's assistant in the U.S. But in seminary, he was introduced in a class, and later, two things happened. One was I met this incredibly gorgeous woman across the hall from me where I was staying, and she happened to be Thurman's goddaughter. And I still love her as much as the first time I saw her.
It's your
Probably
wife, yeah.
not. And but the primary connection was when he came to the seminary and spoke. I was the person asked to pick him up at the airport. And from there, a relationship began, and later I studied with Thurman in the late 70s. And I had no idea that this would be a watershed moment for me. This would be a watershed moment. But it changed me forever. Yeah, in Thurman's presence at one meeting, all I could do was write poetry. And I'm not alone. There are other people. He had this thing that sang, you've seen it on the internet. This guy comes, Gil Bailey comes to Thurman and says, I'm a graduate student. I don't know what I'm really going to do with my life. Blah, 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 blah. And Thurman says, go and do what makes you come alive.
Come alive, yeah.
And because the world needs people who come alive. And Thurman's presence, I and many others, came alive. And all he was doing was laughing most of the
That's
Man.
awesome.
Oh,
So
God.
good.
He's a funny man.
Let me follow up with a question from James. He listened to our first podcast conversation where we talked about Thurman's idea of the inner life a little bit. I think we talked about Jones and the inner life. He says, according to Thurman, what is the source of the inner life? He says, it is not commitment, question mark. It is not fear. It is not personal integrity. Why or why not? What is the source of the inner life?
Well, you should know commitment is important to Thurman. Suffering is very prominent in Thurman. Source, he thinks, is given. They're already by virtue of creation for people who are religious, by virtue of creation. It's almost like at the risk of being heady, it's a sacramentalistic ontology. When you're on a date or something, use that, and that'll get you. But it's really like an implant. It's given. I cannot escape it, Thurman thinks. I can ignore it, but it's still there. So the source is given in creation. And it's using Eckhart's language, Meister Eckhart, the mystic. He says that it's part of the Godhead, which is resident within the individual. It is
Is
not
it?
God, but it's part of the Godhead, which is the apex, which is already within. And our task is to discover it. To become aware of it, to work on. Commitment is a discipline for them. It is through my commitment that I become more and more aware of this wonderful gift, which is given to me in creation.
Is it fair to call that the Imago Dei, like the image of God in us? Is that,
That, yes, he was designed with the image of God. But he wants to be explicit that it is given. You can't earn it. Not to do how he approaches salvation, therefore, which trips up some, sometimes. But he is, isn't it a wonderful thing? At least for me, he uses this Indian proverb where he says, "Why would a fish in the ocean complain about the water?" Something like that. Why would I go play hungry when there's so much available? Those ideas. But our job is to do the digging. And for him, that requires disciplines of the spirit.
Which we'll hopefully talk about more in a second. We may have already kind of answered this, but I'll just see if it sparks anything else for you. Tony asks, how does Thurman's wisdom to wait and listen for the sound of the genuine continue to help you find your voice? And I don't know if he means you in particular or the kind of royal you, but how does this wisdom to wait and listen for the sound of the genuine continue to help you find your voice?
Yeah, it's an everyday encounter for me. Finding my voice, returning to the well to drink. This idea of the sound, though, you hear that he's interested in the sound of the genuine. Genuine really comes from this idea of genius, the spirit within. The sound, I like to think of the spirit, which is in all things and is always calling. And to be in a space where I can hear it. So it's not just my cognitive apparatus, my reason, my technical reason, where we are in the world today, in fact, but especially in the Western world, my mind. No, it's more. It's this dimension of self where we hide things from ourselves. And so to listen for this, it means that I must, one, become aware of the things that block the sound or the hearing, or I must listen deeply. Thich Nhat Hanh's idea of listening deeply. And for Thurman, this has a long stream of mystical thinkers. But for Thurman, to hear the sound of the river means that you leave home and you never return, because you're on your way to another home, which is already there. Isn't that kind of deep? But it's, you leave home like the son in the parable, Luke, and you leave home in order to come home.
Right.
My, that's good preaching. Preachers in the audience, you could use that.
I'm thinking of Chesterton's The Man Who Travels Around the World to Come Home as for the first time. Interesting. Interesting. Sometimes reading Thurman too, I get that Hopkins, Gerard Manley Hopkins and Duns Scotus, and the idea of the thisness of things, that things just are because of being held in by the creator. I don't know. There's I don't know.
It,
It's,
this
do you know?
part of that tradition I'm speaking to, but it's more for Thurman in among the Rhineland mystics, as they're called. That's Eckhart, that's a Burma, Rhineland, like
Okay.
Rhineland.
Rylan.
But and this comes all goes all the way back to Plotinus and other folks, Augustine. But this idea of a seed, this immutable, unchangeable, unalterable, I just to go on, the idea that it's already given. The ancients called it the logos, spermatikos, all of these things. But the idea is that it is substantive. It is, in many ways, the only fixed thing, but the Thurman is fixed while it is fluid. It, nothing is fixed except this, and it's fluid. It's a fluid sentence. That's a longer conversation. I don't want to bore your audience, but it's the fluid center of your consent. It has a lot to do with the will, your will, not just your head, but the will, the educated, the disciplined will.
So if someone is really intrigued by this part of the conversation, what should they read next of Thurman?
Get our book on the mystics as it comes out. But I would definitely recommend The Creative Encounter and The Disciplines of the Spirit, where he talks about these, because he's dealing with these ideas. That's not in Jesus and the Disinherited as much, though it foreshadows its presence. But the serious conversations he's having are in essays collected here and elsewhere. But the Creative Encounter, Disciplines of the Spirit are books I would recommend immediately. And then The Search for Common Ground is a larger philosophical treatise by Thurman.
Thank you. Deliza, I sure hope I'm saying her name right. asked about, she talks about in Jesus and the Disinherited, where Thurman talks about the positive effect that a parent can have on a child when they themselves embrace the place they have as a child of God. And then she just wonders about Thurman's own autobiography. She says, it appears that Howard Thurman was uniquely positioned to write Jesus and the Disinherited and to act as a pastor to the leaders of the civil rights movement. We know a little bit about the influence of his grandmother and mother instilling these ideas in him. What other factors uniquely positioned Howard Thurman to write this book and play this role? More things in his upbringing?
My grandma Nancy is killed. And that's a dissertation to talk about her, honestly.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Thurman is his closest companion are in nature. When you read Jesus and the Disinherited, keep in mind the natural images, the dog behind the fence, the rabbit being chased by hounds, the snake, nocturnal snake, the cuttlefish, the nature, trees. He talks to trees.
There's a particular tree, right? That's a right. Friend of his. Yeah.
So it's in nature. And I suspect, and there's some work done on this, that Thurman has, he's born in Florida. Florida is not far from Georgia and South Carolina, where Grandma Nancy originates from, which was a major port for slaves from West Africa, the Gula people. You hear Geechee people, where this idea of being one with nature and open to alternative, we call them alternative consciousnesses, is part of Thurman. And you see it more when you read him closely. He's not thinking of ghosts in the way we think of ghosts, but he has a world crowded with consciousnesses. And it's not just the human consciousness that is central to all things. No, not for Thurman. He thinks that I can discover this unity when I'm able to feel it with animals. Has a story in one of these books I suggested about the great German shepherd, Rin Tin Tin. Remember, that's older than you, I'm sorry. But for some of us,
I've heard of Rin Tin Tin.
Rin Tin Tin. And how the trainer gave him to a gentleman who discovered the dog was on a regular schedule. Around 5 or so in the evening, he'd go out to a cliff and he'd sit in quiet repose. And soon the man joins him. And he says, boy, this dog is having an experience. Anyway, so in this camp, and for some people, again, you can see why he may not have made it into the strict canons of certain traditional ecclesial structures. But I think of that as African retentions that are very strong via Grandma Nancy and many of these people in those communities, where there were ex-slaves or enslaved Africans.
Fascinating.
I love religion.
Well, this maybe leads us to Keith's question, which he phrased as, it's a question about the connection between theology and social justice, religion and ethics is the way we've been talking about it so far. So the way he asked it was, he said, I'm just curious as to whether good social justice cancels out bad theology, or does theology even matter? I quibble a little bit with that question because we could spend the next 16 hours on what is good theology. But I think I'm glad Keith asked the question because I guess, what is the relationship between theology and social justice? How do you think about that? How did Thurman think about that?
I think it's a good question for our time, given our context. It'd be good to see how social justice needs to ethical to drive religion and especially theology to reflect on itself in different ways. So I'm open to that. But Thurman is both and. It's a good religion drives social justice. Spirituality is inextricably linked to social transformation. because the individual who is seeking God, however defined, is impelled, maybe compelled, into the larger arena of social justice, because she discovers that the things that are ailing the society are also within her.
Right.
So I cannot get home again until I'm able, Thurman says, to struggle against every form and expression of that so that I can be free. So that I can be, and there are numerous quotes in Thurman where he says, my job is to make sure I'm not the one who holds the key to the prison door. And so my quest to find God, to be at home at last, for eternal life, to eternal security, whatever language you use, is bound to my quest in the struggle for justice. But it has to be good religion. Thurman studied the spirituals early on in his career. The foundation of much of Jesus and the Disinherited comes out of his work, which is also published later in 1944 under the title Deep River and the Negro Spiritual Speaks of Life and Death. That was a 1944 Ingersoll lecture at Harvard. Deep River and the Negro Spiritual Speaks of Life and Death. He says in these spirituals that there is so much wisdom. So one of the spirituals is you got good religion? Not just any kind of religion. The enslaved Africans would look at their masters who were tormenting them, living above them, and they saw that they had religion. But is you got good religion? And then the old slave singers would say, certainly, Lord, certainly, 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 Lord. Is you got good religion? So this is an incredible question. So Thurman's question for us is an intersection of both religion and the ethical life. Yeah. They are inseparable. And the ethical life for him is defined, someone may have asked this question, but is defined by what he calls the pursuit for wholeness.
Wholeness.
Wholeness. W-H-O-L-E. Wholeness or integrity. Sometimes he uses the language of the integrity of my act. So how do I act out of this center, this sound of the genuine, my central consent that is given? How do I act out of this in a way that draws me into wholeness? But again, I cannot experience even my wholeness without you. So I fight justice, not because justice demands this. I fight for justice because I want to be whole. And I can never be whole without finding you, my sister, my brother. But maybe these damaged aspects of nature, our ecological order. I must not be a fowler in my own nest, Thurman said. Until I find that and write that, I can not even dream of being whole. So suffering is at the heart of it. If you do that, you got to suffer.
What's at the heart of it? Say that again. Suffering.
Suffering. It's the most dominant theme in all of Thurman's corpus. Suffering. Nobody gets home without suffering. The battle between integrity and, for Thurman, compassion, or integrity and love, is the way he gets to the cross. Because my truth may say one thing, but compassion urges me at points not to go with what I'm calling truth. The higher good may be my compassion. And then sometimes my compassion gets in the way of two. And he says the reconciliation of the two is this place of the cross. And an interesting interpretation of Jesus, he says essentially the same. Jesus is trying to work through his truth as a son of Israel over against the need to have compassion for the least of these. That's in his African Journal in 1965. But that's the idea. So this thing of suffering is at the heart of what he's doing.
That leads us really well to one of Cheryl's questions. Sort of thinking about, Renovari, we're all about spiritual formation, inviting people we really resonate with, Thurman's idea of the disciplines of the spirit. We have Dallas Willard, one of the voices in our community, wrote a book called Spirit of the Disciplines. So we're breathing some of the same air. But what Cheryl asks is, let me read you her whole question because it'll give some good context. She says, so next in Renovari, we're going to read William Law's book, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. Let it not be said that we are not diverse. We speak a lot about spiritual formation and spiritual practices. However, it seems that one of the main influences for Thurman was his grandmother, who was illiterate and probably didn't have much control over her life or schedule. Our spiritual practices, at least the way we're thinking about them at Renovari, like having a rule of life and some intentionality around spiritual practices, are they only for those whose backs are not up against the wall? How did the Negro slave reach such depths of spirituality without being able to read, worship, have daily time for contemplation, etc.? Are we putting, now this is, she's asking this of the Renovari community, but it'll be interesting to hear what you say. Are we putting too much emphasis on our routine and schedule and missing the deeper transformation that comes from suffering and reconciliation? Do you have thoughts about that?
Those are not, often in classrooms, I said, those are not interrogatives, those are declarative statements. So she speaks to you. Thank you very much. I was struck by one question in particular. So spirituality is not for those. There was a negative in there somewhere that didn't quite go with the
flow. Oh, she said, are spiritual practices only for those whose back are not up against the wall?
Oh my Lord. It's almost a converse. So that's why I'm saying that's a declarative statement, right? For those whose backs are against the wall, merely means, this is in my language, merely means that they're not awake. Because if there's someone now who is incarcerated unjustly, according to Thurman, I'm holding the key if I'm not working against it.
So you're saying there is no person whose back is not up against the wall, right? If we're bound up in the other.
Right. And so spirituality is the practice of becoming more aware, not just of myself, because I do understand the question. If it's self-help, if I can go through Barnes and Noble and shop online and find the right kind of book, help me to become a more prominent middle-class, upper-middle-class person, and more bourgeois in my representation, go for it. But that's not what Thurman is talking about.
I hope it's not what Renovari is talking about, too.
I think that's not what he's saying either. That's the
point.
And so suffering and reconciliation are at the heart of this question. This question about the enslaved Africans and the Grandma Nancy, I think looking at Deep River and the Negro spiritual speaks of life and death is a good place to begin to answer some of that question, as I understand it, which is Thurman learned so much from this community of people in his autobiography at his father's death. These people knew exactly what to do. It wasn't just Grandma Nancy. There was a community of discourse and practice. Illiterate does not mean unknowing. In fact, I've taught at Harvard, Vanderbilt, all of these places. And some of the most annoying people I've met have been in those institutions, in my estimation. Yeah. They're very literate. And so my point is, these folks, Thurman says that his grandma had a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that there was something magic in reading.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted him to learn that. But she mm-hmm. knew some other things. And I dare say they have a lot to do with what we've been calling integrity and deep compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And one does not get home without reconciliation, which is wholeness to Thurman. And this reconciliation for Thurman is synonymous in his mind with this compassion for the other. The Dalai Lama has a great way of talking about compassion, which I think is Thurman's idea. I cannot bear the thought of another suffering. Respond out of compassion because I cannot bear the thought of yourself. And for Thurman, this is what drives Jesus. The love ethic is the last chapter in the book, Jesus and the Disinherited. Mm-hmm. And love is synonymous in this respect with reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
It's really love melded, M-E-L-D-E-D, the truth.
Hmm.
Truth. Love and truth are really married.
Hmm.
They've been a union for quite a while.
So in with Cheryl's question, I think, you know, we had a few days ago at Renovari, we had a webinar on having an intentional rule of life. And when I read her question, I almost kind of thought it's like some of us need an exercise regime because the way our life looks is sedentary, and so we have to go to the gym. And others of us are working manual labor and don't need an exercise regime. And I almost feel like the, you know, Thurman's ancestors, spiritual practice was so much a part of their survival and their existence, they didn't need to sit down and write out a rule of life. Whereas for those of us who at least have the illusion of being somewhat removed from that fight for survival, we might have to have a little more intentionality and structure at least to get us started. Do you think that that's fair?
I think it's both and.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, you don't learn to ride a bicycle until you learn to ride the bicycle. And that mm-hmm. is such a discipline. I know that from trying to help children ride. But here's something I really want us to reflect upon. Why is there such an urge now for us to return to these rules? Whether it's Benedictine
mm-hmm.
or you name the Dominican rules. I mean, just, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a drive in the culture, especially in white evangelical culture, for a return. It's also very large, of course, in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting that you don't do that, but ask why. Why is there sometimes it's almost as if it's a retreat from culture.
Hmm.
It's a retreat to a place where we can feel safe. I've forgotten a book I read recently where they're really taking the lead of Alasdair MacIntyre's After Virtue for people who like to read this stuff. And he's really suggesting a return to something like the Benedictine order.
I think it's called the Benedictine Option. Is that the book you're thinking of? Yeah. Yeah.
And I read it quickly for that same reason, because I think there's something, especially among the West, which is sometimes a synonym for white supremacy, often underneath that. And I think it's because not all people, and certainly not your club members, watch the larger cultural trend because it escaped from something else that is far more present. And I think it's related to this call for social justice. And confronting our deepest fears that the world has changed. My language is, I wrote a whole book about it called The Ground Has Shifted. The world has changed. And guess what? We're no longer number one. And I would run to Jesus too. But in the prophet Amos suggests that if you run from what, the bear, you put your hand on the shelf and the adder or the snake is there. You know, there's no hiding place. Old slaves used to sing, you can run to the mountain, but there's no hiding place. You can run. And I'm suggesting that we need to at least be aware of that. And I name myself in this kind of spiritual quest, which sometimes and can allow us to escape the mandate of justice.
Yeah, that's a good word. I think to clarify, our conversation about a rule of life was an intentionality around practice that would help us attend to the inner life, attend to, we would say, the presence of Jesus in our life, to be the kind of people to find that kind of integrity to act for justice. But really good word that it can easily turn into a retreat for the demands of, no, it's a good word. It's a good word. But I just wanted to clarify, we're not... This is good. Hey, we are almost out of time and there are so many good questions left. Was there any you spotted you wanted to for sure answer, or should I just pick?
Well, you know, you trust me with these updated questions, but I can tell you Walter Cooper probably didn't get them all done.
Fair. No, it's good. I think I'll ask another question from Cheryl, and then I'm also gonna, if you can hang on a couple extra minutes, I'll take a quick look.
Good.
At a couple of the live ones here. But Cheryl, I thought, had a really insightful question about Thurman mentions the need to operate from a core of reality. And the issues happening around the world, but it seems like particularly in America, about what is truth and these kind of echo chambers that each side is in, and this confusion around truth. So let me see how she says, it seems to me that America today has gone off the rails when it comes to reality from both left and right, from the non-acceptance of the birth gender to the embrace of conspiracy theories. Too many are living in an unreal world, is how she put it. How would Thurman address or interact with someone who does not live in reality?
This question of the seat, which is also in Jesus and the Disinherited, is another major trope in Thurman, a theme. Always asking, how do I guard against self-deception? How can I know something is genuine and for real? And he guards against that, even as he says Jesus on the cross is asking that too. Did I get it right, God? You know, but but he says we guard against that by always keeping in balance both reason and spirit. It's a dialectical relationship. I'm always asking the hardcore rational question of whether or not my truth has rational coherence. Because for Thurman, this order in the world, which is profoundly spiritual and created, emanates from the mind of God. And it has a deep rational ordering to it. He talks about a doctor he went to regarding his weight. Thurman was a little corpulent. And the doctor told him to lose weight. And he said to the doctor, boy, I'm looking at you. And you're a little rounder than I am. But it was still true that he needed to lose weight. That's my point. And that, so there ought to be a rational coherence. And he's constantly wrestling with this thing for himself. How do I know that even after I've done my best, that's also the moral struggle, whether I'm right. And finally, he counsels the canons of reason, but always emanating from this deep attunement with this spiritual core that we've been talking about. So he believes in rationality.
Yeah.
He's not a pilot.
Have you seen the documentary The Social Dilemma?
No, and it's been on my list for a month.
The list. Yeah, I was reading, I think it's in the chapter on hate in Jesus and the Disinherited, where he talks about hate can develop when there's contact with the other without genuine fellowship. And boy, it made me think of that and how now those of us who participate in social media are being fed. The algorithm figures out what we think and then continues to feed that to us. And if you ever sort of accidentally click into what the other side thinks, and then the next morning you wake up and your feed is all this stuff of the other side, and it's like really disorienting, and you realize how much you're having contact with the other without genuine fellowship. Yes, the ground of rationality, but there's something about this, what you've been saying about me getting home depends on the other as well.
And this center for Thurman, which is like a Geiger counter. He sometimes uses the language, I have my own little Geiger counter here that puts me in acts of discernment. So there's a discernment, and I really want to get back to the social media piece, but I know time is a lot, but there's a place for discernment, certainly spiritual discernment, but it's in partnership, it's in relationship with the rational. So it's hard work. And I will comment on what I see as this kind of clandestine puppeteers hiding behind the curtains of digitized social fiction, manipulating the mindscape and setting us up. To kill one another, to maim one another, to injure one another. And I think Thurman can be a great guide because for those who are working on this path that we've been talking about for the last hour, at the heart of it, it'll scare some very traditional, is an intelligence term. It's some call it a divine intelligence. Thurman calls it the mind of God. And to always be so in touch with this. Now, that may not solve a political dispute, but it takes you into the conversation with openness to the possibility that you might be wrong. How do I know I'm not being deceived? So this issue of doubt for Thurman is a factor. I should have self-doubt, but I must qualify that with this kind of move toward rational coherence. It's either or it's nothing. That doesn't wash with Thurman. But Thurman, it's more like a dialectic, either or, and there's a synthesis that is found with this.
Right.
I must test it here. He's constantly talking about testing.
Right. So at Renovari, we would talk about the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Was there a place for him in his way of thinking about it?
He loved the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
In fact, everything for Thurman really was the Holy Spirit. His favorite psalm is Psalm 139. Oh God, thou hast searched me and known me. And his eyes go back in his head. He tells Rabbi Schachter Shalami. Do you know this name? Jewish Reform Movement?
I don't.
Well, he's a young student. He later becomes this huge mover in Reform Judaism. He's a student. He meets Thurman in Marsh Chapel in BU. He thinks Thurman is the janitor.
Because
of these kind of racial stereotypes, and he doesn't have a place to pray. because they have the cross up there. And so the next day he shows up in this little basement in Marsh Chapel, and there are menorahs and all of this stuff in the same place. And he wonders who put it there. And later when he goes to class, there he walks in. This is in the 50s. There's this big black guy who he thought was
the janitor. Thurman
meets him. Yeah. And they talk this through. And Thurman says to him in fluent Hebrew, "Do you not believe in the Holy Spirit?" And this was transformative, much like I was sharing with you earlier. And it transformed, I'm telling you, this Eastern European Jew into a person who was far more inclusive, embracing not just other people, but other religions and other thoughts. There are a lot of testimonies on this, probably online, where you can find that story. But my point is, this is my point. Yeah, he believed in the spirit, he says, is the spirit of truth, to get back to the question.
Yeah. So good. So good. We are out of time. I'm going to ask you a couple of quick, easy ones that were submitted while we were talking. One is, will you post these resources that he's referencing? Yes, we will do our best. Everything that we've mentioned, we will post. What is the title of the book behind Dr. Pflueger, The Ground Over His Right Shoulder? I think we talked about it, but will you say again the title of that book?
Moral Struggle.
He thought it started with The Ground, but
The Ground Is Shifted is a book that in 2016.
That's your book, Dr. Pflueger's book, The Ground Has Shifted. And then that one is...
Those are sermon series. That's the first
right. book. Okay, great.
Reading.
Excellent. And then Mary Flo wanted to know who is in the photograph behind Dr. Pflueger. I think I know the answer to that. That's Howard Thurman. That's our man.
That's my teacher. That's the guy who took me to the dance.
Yep. I love it. And then somebody asked, Alexi said, you have mentioned spirituals a few times. Is there an album or songs of African-American spirituals that you would suggest to better understand Thurman?
I've mentioned Thurman. Get it from him. But there are all kinds of collections. Especially in major denominations, they have an African-American spiritual hymn book in the United Methodist Church, where all of the spirituals are. But for people who have written on the spirituals in recent times, I would recommend John J-O-N Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R. John, and he has a middle name, which escapes me because I'm approaching 70.
I was researching the other day, the background on Go Tell It on the Mountain, and his name came up. He was, so we'll find him. We'll find him, John Spencer.
And other people who were brought up in this same tradition, believe it or not, people like James Baldwin and others who are always comment, Toni Morrison, and they always intertwining the spirituals into their work.
Yeah. And that's that right there, if I can sound the Renovari horn for a minute, shows the power of spiritual practice that's ingrained in our lives. Something like singing those spirituals day after day after day gets so woven in the way we understand God and each other in the world. Okay, can I ask you one more before we sign off?
One more thing for you?
Yes, please.
My wife this morning told me about something I need to listen to. I know the song already. It's I've been running for Jesus a long time, but I ain't tired yet. I ain't that tired yet. And so it's the Mississippi Mass Choir.
Okay.
Mine. And if you like to shout with your religion, you'll do that.
Okay.
I've been Jesus a long time.
And I ain't got tired yet.
That's an old song.
We will find it. We'll post it. Thank you. Okay, can I ask you one more? This is from Alexa. I like this because it's a really practical question. She says, as a white woman in the South, what do you think is the most important thing I can do to promote racial reconciliation?
I think you need to join some kind of organization, whether it's church affiliated or not, that is seeking
seeking justice, to rectify injustice. Nowadays, I'm most interested in ways in which people who don't think they can play a major part find out that they have so much to offer. The Equal Justice Initiative in Birmingham, I don't know where she's from, is one of the places you might want to go. It deals with the issue of incarceration.
That's Brian Stevenson, yeah?
I take students there on tours. Study Martin Luther King. It's a site of memory. I would certainly recommend being in touch with organizations like that. The Southern Poverty Law Center here in Georgia. Anything that Stacey Abrams is doing around voting, I recommend that very highly. But there are places where you can go and become engaged.
Yeah.
And they would be happy for you to volunteer.
Love it. Love it. Thank you. This has been a real gift. So thank you so much.
Oh, you all have been a gift. Love every one of you. And I love every moment of preparing for this. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone for hanging out here with us and for all your excellent questions and engagement. We'll see you next time. Thanks.
Ain't got tired yet.
Ain't got tired yet. Blessings. See ya.